Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Republican analyst Kevin Phillips, whose new book prompted a questioner to ask President Bush this week, "Mr. President, do you believe in the apocalypse?" But first, more news from the struggling U.S. auto industry. This morning, General Motors and its main auto parts supplier, the bankrupt Delphi Corporation, struck a deal with United Auto Workers Union to buy out 113,000 hourly workers. If that agreement is approved, unionized workers will receive payouts ranging from $35,000 to up to $140,000, depending on years of service. Joining us on the line from Detroit is Mark Truby. He's business editor for the Detroit News. And Mark, I know you're in the middle of this story, and so thanks for helping us out with it. Can you start by reminding us, what's the recent history of these two companies? You know, how are they financially?
Well, both companies are in serious financial turmoil. Delphi's in bankruptcy, as a matter of fact, has been such that they filed Chapter 11 in October and is trying to come up with a way to emerge from bankruptcy. It was the largest industrial bankruptcy in the history of the United States, and General Motors lost $10.6 billion last year, and their bonds are rated below junk bond status. And some folks think that they may eventually go into bankruptcy, barring a pretty fast turnaround.
Well, so how is this deal being viewed, first, I guess, by investors, because stocks did go up on the announcement?
Yeah, this is seen here on Wall Street and here in Detroit as a potentially big step for General Motors, because they're going to, in one action, they're going to be able to get a lot of workers off of their books. They're going to be able to deal with Delphi, obligations they have to Delphi that date all the way back to when Delphi was spun off from GM in 1999, and GM retained some obligations, some post-retirement obligations to those workers. So they're trying to clear the decks in what is just a massive, maybe unprecedented buyout program that they're offering, as you said, to more than 100,000 workers. Now, not all those workers are going to take the program, and the real number is likely to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 workers. But still, we've never seen an exodus of auto workers like that in the past.
Well, I was going to say, how's it being viewed around Detroit?
Well, I think people say are almost getting numb to these huge announcements of layoffs and job cuts. But these are what they call in Detroit soft landings. Nobody's getting burned. Everybody's getting a check to leave. And I think we all understand here in Detroit that it's the end of an era, but it's not as painful as it could be, because there's a lot of, you know, people are leaving with retirement benefits and lump sum payouts and things of that nature. So why I think there's concern about the future of the auto industry, the workers understand that this may be their last best chance to get out with a nest egg.
And this comes as there seems to be a lot of pain in the city, continuing pain. We just want to ask you, in the minute we have, Detroit Mayor Kilpatrick says the city needs to borrow $130 million by June or it'll go broke. And we understand some Detroit schools were closed today because as many as 1,500 teachers called in sick, apparently in a pay dispute there. It's a tough day.
Yeah, I mean, we have to understand that Detroit used to be a city of 2 million, and that's what the infrastructure it has is. And now there's less than a million people there, and that tax base cannot support the city services and schools in Detroit, and it's more or less collapsing and about fall into receivership. And a lot of that has to do with what's happened with the industrial Midwest and the auto industry, and it's a time of, you know, we feel like we're in a different economy than the rest of the country.
Mark Truby, business editor for the Detroit News. Thanks for speaking with us.
Sure.
President Bush is on the road again today, taking his message on Iraq to Wheeling, West Virginia, the audience there mostly military families. All this week, the president has faced pointed questions about the war. On Tuesday, during a White House news conference, reporter Helen Thomas pressed the president on why he attacked Iraq. His response, boiled down, was that his longstanding argument that the 9/11 attacks justified the invasion of Iraq. Well, our next guest would beg to differ. He says the reason for the war in Iraq was oil. Kevin Phillips is a former Republican strategist. In his 1969 book, The Emerging Republican Majority, he correctly predicted the party would move into the South and Southwest, taking over the area he named the Sun Belt, and he was credited with helping shape the future success of the party. In his new book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century, he details what he says has gone dangerously wrong. And Kevin Phillips joins us in the studio now. Kevin, welcome.
Happy to be with you.
Well, let's start with oil. You write, the U.S. has had a reckless dependency on shrinking oil supplies. But still, oil, the sole reason for war?
No, it's not the sole reason for war. But, of course, the administration, the president, Dick Cheney, they have denied that oil played any role, which is really quite misleading because nothing matters so much in the Persian Gulf, which includes Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, as oil. And that's been true for 100 years. If you look at the maps of that area, going back to World War I and earlier, what was really important on the maps was where the oil fields were. The political boundaries didn't mean much. And when Dick Cheney was running the research into oil in that task force in 2001, well before the invasion of Iraq, they were looking at the maps of Iraq and how the oil fields were arranged. So believe me, that may not have been 90% of the explanation, but it was certainly 40 or 50%.
We'll talk about some of that other percentage, but, you know, staying with oil, you, as you say, petroleum has dominated American activity in the Middle East for 100 years, a full century. You also write that because the U.S. is running out of its own oil sources, a military solution to an energy crisis is hardly a lunacy.
Well, it isn't a lunacy if you do it intelligently and you have a serious strategy. If you've got a half-baked approach that's half democratic pretense and half reports of weapons of mass destruction and no coherent plan for getting out, then it's a disaster.
I mean, in other words, are you saying if the U.S. had, with a coalition, invaded Iraq and stated it's to protect the oil interests, would have been perhaps more honest and more acceptable?
No, I don't think you could have done that simply because one of the other ingredients in the invasion of Iraq was the way in which it was blurred into the whole question of terrorism through 9/11. And for a large percentage of the president's coalition, one of the major contexts of everything they think about the Middle East is religious. Because some 45% of American Christians believe that Armageddon is coming and the Antichrist is already alive. Within the Republican coalition, that's probably 55 to 60%.
Well, let's talk about that other element. You know, you have your three-pronged view of the party now. Your book, by the way, was reviewed this Sunday in the New York Times, and it caught a lot of people's attention, especially this premise that the Republican Party is dangerously dominated by religious extremists. You write, the rapture, end times, Armageddon hucksters in the U.S. rank with any Shiite ayatollahs, and the last two presidential elections marked the transformation of the GOP into the first religious party in U.S. history. A lot of things to touch on there, but first, just the rapture. This is the belief in the prophecies of the Book of Revelations that those who believe will be lifted to heaven and the rest left behind.
Yes, and this is part of the end times, and it culminates in Armageddon, and it's a fight between good and evil. And it takes place in the Holy Land, and Iraq is virtually the center of that geography.
Well, tell us more, though, Kevin Phillips. I mean, how, you know, there are people, you know, on Main Street attending church who might believe that, but how did that impact U.S. policy?
Well, let me give a context here. The people in the White House know who elected them. The coalition was very heavily bulwarked by evangelicals, fundamentalists, Pentecostals, mostly Protestants, but beyond that too. So that as these people think about what goes on in the Middle East, they tend to view things through the lens of the Bible and everything that they're hearing about in church and with pastors who interpret the end times. It's a huge block in the Republican Party. So as George Bush went into Iraq, he couldn't talk about oil, because in the books that are put out by these preachers, oil is something that's dabbled in by the Antichrist. And some people thought Saddam Hussein was the Antichrist. I mean, it's hard to believe, but the numbers are staggering. And the White House, even if it had a very concrete plan, would have been quite right to know that a big percentage of its electorate interpreted all of this, not in anything having to do with weapons of mass destruction, but this biblical confrontation. And whether there were WMDs there or not didn't matter. So,
well, but tell us more specifically, why Iraq?
Well, because Iraq is Baghdad was the new Babylon, and Babylon was the evil city of the Bible. And the whole fight in Armageddon takes place about 100 and 150 miles away from there in what is now Israel. But Babylon was the evil city. So Saddam Hussein, as part of what he did, he was rebuilding Babylon.
In the view of these.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, he was physically.
He was.
He was restoring it. He had the sense of this confrontation, too. And after the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union broke up, a lot of the fundamentalist and evangelical preachers basically said the new evil in the world is Islam.
Well, I just want to talk for a second because the president spoke Monday at the City Club in Cleveland, and a questioner in the audience asked him about this, in fact, was prompted by your book. Let's listen.
Author and former Nixon administration official Kevin Phillips, in his latest book, American Theocracy, discusses what has been called radical Christianity and its growing involvement into government and politics. He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this, that the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism are signs of the apocalypse? And if not, why not?
Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella.
The president did go on for several minutes to talk at length about how his motivation for the war in Iraq derived from September 11th, his commitment to protecting Americans. He never mentioned the question he'd been asked, and he never directly answered the question. But your thoughts, Kevin, about his response?
Well, he can't. He can't answer that question because about half of his constituency believes this is happening. But if he says he believes and he supports this whole interpretation, then your ordinary mainline mainstream Catholics and Protestants are, hey, wait a minute. This isn't our stuff.
He's sort of trapped because if he,
absolutely.
Then, according to your theory, if he says, that's the craziest thing I ever heard, then he's insulting.
He's insulting his bedrock, his core voters, the people he's reached out to in speech after speech, which has one layer of sort of bland religion at the top, but underneath it touches all these chords of different parts of the Bible and different hymns and different sayings. This is a huge electorate. It's central to him, and he can't discuss it.
That's Kevin Phillips. His new book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Tell you what, we're going to take a quick break and come back to talk about some of the other things that you say are the new underpinnings of the Republican Party. We spoke about a thirst for oil, the religiosity, talk more about that, but also overspending, perhaps because if you feel the apocalypse is coming, what do you care about debt? But also, Kevin, you've got your critics, so we'll hear their voices as well. Much more coming up with Kevin Phillips here and now. Kevin Phillips, his new book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Before the break, we spoke about the first two themes of your book, Thirst for Oil, and what you see as the religious rights take over the Republican Party. But before we move from that topic, you know, do you have proof that there are people, evangelicals who believe in the end times and Armageddon, who have spoken, you know, about that in shaping U.S. policy?
Well, when you say spoken about it in shaping U.S. policy, some have been in touch with Condoleezza Rice and others in the White House. There's no doubt about this, and there are certainly a number of controversies over how close the acquaintance is. But the number of people who represent this outlook and their position in the conservative movement is beyond doubt. I'm sure in the coming weeks we're going to see some interesting analyses of this, and the question will become, how much did they influence the administration? And I frankly don't know. It's just that there's such a large group that when you would speak to your constituency, half of what you're speaking to are people who see it through this light. And the fact that the New York Times or the Boston Globe don't see it remotely like that sort of keeps the media from understanding that this is there's an iceberg under what you see of people who interpret things through the Bible.
But what are you saying? I mean, again, you just remarked, and this is probably your answer, that you don't really know what's happening in inner sanctums. But are you saying that President Bush and Dick Cheney are sitting in a room and saying, you know, Saddam Hussein is building the new Babylon, we've got to stop him?
No. Cheney certainly wouldn't say that. I mean, we sort of wonder when and if Cheney goes to church. I think Cheney handles the tanks and the oil, and George Bush handles the Bible. So you leave Cheney out of the equation. But does George Bush? Yes, he does, because anybody who wants to go online and track down all the statements he's alleged to have made, and some of which we know he made, about God wanted him to run for president, about the inerrancy of the Bible. He's been people who were his preachers say he believes every bit of the Bible. He certainly can't say he doesn't. Pennsylvania in 2004, he was speaking in an area where there are a lot of old Amish, the plain people. And he said if he didn't know that God spoke through him, he couldn't do his job.
The third concern you talk about, you call the financialization of the economy, refer to debt as the global fifth horseman. We know about the huge rising debt. How do you connect the debt to religion and oil?
Well, let me state quickly what's happened with the debt. Debt has become such a big business in the United States, especially with credit cards and mortgage finance. But then the government borrowing and the international debt, that we now have the financial services industry, which is the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, is now much larger than the manufacturing sector. Back in the early 70s, the manufacturing sector would have led by 2-1. That was where Americans got their jobs and their money. But now the FIRE sector, financial services, is 21% of GDP, and manufacturing has dropped to 13. Now, what this means is that essentially this is a society that has as its culture and its source of income moving money around. We no longer make very much. And that's built up a huge amount of debt, and there's starting to be quite a lot of concern, especially in places like New York and Boston, about what might happen to housing prices and the dominoes that would fall in the economy.
Well, why would the formerly fiscally responsible Republicans make this shift? I mean, I alluded to it when we ended the previous break, that if, in fact, as you say, so many of them now are, you know, believing in end times, does that have something to do with it? I mean, I said it almost flippantly, but is it possible that if you believe there's an apocalypse coming, does that change your view of debt?
I think it makes you much less concerned, because your concern is with personal salvation and religious issues, and you tend not to be concerned with whether debt is being built up in a way you might otherwise have. So that's a problem. But as far as the Republican Party goes, even back in the 1980s, as the debt problem started to build and as the deficits grew, a lot of Republicans said, well, this is good because we're cutting taxes. So even though we're going into debt to do it, we're giving money back to people. And they still feel that way. Part of the reason why the debt is building up so much now has to do with the size of the tax cuts. So that there is a reason Republicans will cut taxes even if it builds up debt.
And you don't let the Democrats off the hook, we should say. You call them a weak and muddled opposition. Give us more of that view.
Well, essentially what I think has happened is one reason why the Republicans could transform themselves in these various directions is that the Democrats lacked either the understanding or the willingness to put the critique right out on the table. I can sit here and talk about this, but I don't have to raise money from people to run for the Senate or for the House of Representatives. They do. And as a result, they've been very, very circumspect in raising controversial issues. And because of that, the Republicans have felt free to let these things go on, and they have not been effectively called to the bar before the American people for it.
And it seems as if the Democrats did seem to mount an attempt to match the Republicans on religious fervor, but it sort of fizzled out.
Oh, no, there's no anything like that. The Democrats have become more and more the party of secular America. Some people in the Democratic Party say, hey, we have to appeal to the religious vote. But what's happened is they used to have a very lopsided share of the Catholic vote, and they don't have it anymore. And they used to have an overwhelming dominance in the Southern Baptists in the South, and they're now 3-4-1 Republican. So they don't know what to do.
Kevin Phillips, his new book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. All three of those things, religion, oil, and debt, he says, are what have become the mainstays of his party. And we only have a minute left. There's so much, probably love to have you back at another time, but in the time we have, given your criticism of the party, what makes you a Republican?
Well, I have a long history with the Republican Party, but right now I'm a registered independent. And I have some hope if John McCain were to be the nominee, but I'm beginning to wonder even about that, because I think what dominates the Republican Party would pull him in, too. So I'm just not very happy with this.
Kevin Phillips. And by the way, listeners in the Boston area, you can hear more from Kevin tonight at the Harvard Bookstore here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And again, for others, his book, American Theocracy. Thanks for some thought-provoking talk today, Kevin.
And thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where
today protesters in the former Soviet Republic of Belarus are rallying against the re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko, saying the process was riddled with fraud. The Soviet-backed Lukashenko claims to have won the election with 83% of the vote, a result questioned by the U.S. and other Western countries. Today, a police commander said security forces would not move against what he called the pathetic crowd, and the protest against Lukashenko being allowed to continue is seen as unprecedented. Stephen Lee Myers is covering the story for the New York Times. He returned to Moscow from Belarus last night. Stephen, can you describe the scene in October Square in the capital city, Minsk?
Sunday night, we saw what was the largest protest against Lukashenko in many years, perhaps the largest since he took office in 1994. And on the square, there was a great deal of excitement and hope that the opposition had managed to rally enough people out to protest what they certainly see as a rigged election.
Well, Mr. Lukashenko has been the president of Belarus almost since it broke from the Soviet Union in 1991.
Actually, the interesting thing is he was originally an opposition candidate. When he ran for president in 1994, he ran as somebody who was going to fight corruption, who was opposed to the entrenched bureaucracy left over from the Soviet times. Once he became president, within years, he began to consolidate his power, began to stifle the opposition. In 1996, he rewrote the Constitution so that it would extend his term in office. He essentially started over with a new presidential term, five-year term. And that vote, at the time, was widely denounced as fraudulent. And since then, every election that he's faced, including a second presidential election and a referendum to extend, essentially remove term limits so he could run forever, has been rigged.
Well, and tell us more about Belarus. We mentioned it broke from the Soviet Union in 91. Where exactly is it geographically, and how do Belarusians identify themselves? Do they identify themselves as European or Russian?
Belarus is on the western edge of Russia, just north of Ukraine. It borders Poland, the Baltic states. One of the things many people will tell you in Belarus is that as a nation, it doesn't have a strong identity the way the Ukrainians certainly do, or the Baltic states even more so. Belarus has always been part of another empire, if you will. At one time it was part of Lithuania, part of it was Polish, part of it was Russian, and it's only been an independent country, except for a brief time after World War I, since 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And I think the main thing that's striking about Belarus is not so much that there's a nostalgia for the Soviet times, but certainly that Lukashenko has recreated many aspects of the Soviet structure, including the security structure, including the economy, as well as effectively a single-party state.
You mentioned neighboring Ukraine. Can you put this protest in context for us? Because, you know, in that region we saw, for instance, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine.
The opposition that ran against Lukashenko. And it's fair to say that, you know, there was still an election here, though not one conducted under any standards that we would understand. But the opposition clearly modeled their effort on what happened in Ukraine. They were inspired by what came to be known as the Orange Revolution and hoped that they would be able to repeat it in Minsk. And everything you saw, I mean, in terms of the campaign, getting people out onto a central square, was inspired by what happened in Kiev. I think that there are many, many differences between Ukraine and Belarus. First, in Ukraine, the opposition actually were in politics. There were opposition parties in the parliament. They had big businessmen who were supporting them. In Belarus, they have none of that. They have no money. They have nobody in parliament. There's no structure within the government that they're able to exploit to put pressure on the president, as the Ukrainians did against President Kuchma.
Well, in fact, Lukashenko's chief opponent is Alexander Milinkevich. Who is he, and how is he different from Lukashenko?
He's an interesting figure. He's what you would call a Belarusian nationalist or patriot. He comes from the west, a town called Grodno, which is near the Polish border. He was a former professor of physics at the university there. He served as a deputy mayor in Grodno during a period that he called the Renaissance of Belarus, that is, the first years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He's a Western-oriented economist, liberal politician, if you will, and was a bit of an unexpected choice. There were many other people within the opposition who were more prominent.
Stephen Lee Myers, again, writing for The New York Times. He's just returned from Belarus. And looking ahead, this Saturday, Belarusians will mark the anniversary of the short-lived Declaration of Independence of Belarus back in 1918. It's expected there will be a major protest of the election on that day, on Saturday. Can you tell us some of the things that Belarusians are saying to you? I mean, you know, as you said, these protests are dwarfed by the ones we saw in Ukraine. So are they fearful?
Well, even before the protests began, there was a great deal of fear in Belarus. You know, it's essentially against the law for people to criticize the government. There have been dozens of arrests, which I think has contributed to the dwindling size of the protests. Having said that, overnight last night, the number of people who stayed on the square grew by a few hundred. It's still only a few hundred. But I think that the plan for Milinkevich now and the people around him is to try to sustain these daily protests until a larger protest on Saturday. I will say, before the election started, I spent a lot of time talking to the opposition, and they had a basic plan, which was to get as many people out as they could on Sunday, and they hoped to get more on Monday. They got less, and it's been less each day. So I think that Saturday is their last hope for trying to get more people out. Remains to be seen whether or not they can do that. But perhaps after a week of protest, if they can make it that long without the police intervening to end it, they're hoping that they can draw more people out, sort of break this fear that is pervasive in society there.
And as you said, it's extraordinary that there's any protest at all. But if they don't get the groundswell on Saturday, do you think that Lukashenko and the riot police will be as reserved as they've been?
It's very hard to say. They've been reserved to the extent that they haven't attacked this protest, as many expected they would, even on Sunday night. But they have arrested, at least by yesterday evening, it was more than 100 people who had been at the protest, including some of the prominent, you know, opposition leaders, newspaper editors. Even Milinkevich's sons were detained briefly, though released, I think in another sign of restraint, as they were trying to bring food and warm clothes to the people who are staying out overnight. So they've acted with restraint only to the extent that they haven't broken up the large protest itself. But I think that they're trying to exert enough pressure on those who are protesting to essentially let it run out of steam itself without them having to intervene, especially when there's still a lot of foreign press there. My colleague is still there, as well as a lot of diplomats, observers still from the election.
Stephen Lee Myers of The New York Times speaking to us from Moscow about the protests of the recent election in Belarus. Stephen, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And a quick program note for you. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to take a look at the ethical dilemmas faced by doctors who administer lethal injections to inmates on death row. Fascinating story. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. and it's down to the Sweet 16 for both the men and the women in the NCAA tournament. The college basketball tournament, the men begin playing again tomorrow, and the women return to the court this weekend, so don't call me. As happens every year, there are a few Cinderella teams to keep an eye on. Here with his preview is only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you, Robin.
And, you know, we've mentioned upsets, and last night there was a great one for Boston College fans, but we've been talking about the men's teams and how they've been doing. They're in the Sweet 16 from Boston College, but last night the women upset the top-ranked team in their bracket, Ohio State.
Right.
They're in the Final 16 as well.
Yep. And when an 8 seed upsets a number 1 seed, you have to consider that a surprise, unless you're willing to call into question the entire structure of the tournament, and I'm pretty sure you can be shot for doing that. I'm not entirely positive. On the other hand, and the reason BC was not highly regarded was they had a terrible time at the end of the regular season, but on the other hand, they beat Notre Dame by 17 points in the first round, so maybe we should have expected this.
You know, are people, I'm loving this women's tourney. Are people following it, Bill? Or, I mean, do you have a sense that, or is it just the guys?
More and more. It's an incremental sort of a thing. People pay more attention to it as it goes along, and as more and more very good teams develop at more and more colleges. So you can't just say, oh, yeah, it's all going to be UConn and Tennessee again. It's not like that anymore.
Well, tell us about some of the other Cinderella teams on the women's side.
Well, I think the closest one to another Cinderella team is maybe Utah. They're a number 5 seed. They knocked off Arizona, which was a 4 seed, Arizona State, and that's the next team that BC has to play. So BC gets to play the underdog role again in the third round, and we'll see how that works out.
Well, on the men's side, a lot of teams, many of us just on the periphery of this, you know, who only get in on this week, haven't heard a lot about George Mason, Wichita, Bradley.
Yes.
I just found out that Bradley's in Peoria.
Yes, indeed. A lot of people learning about Bradley this week.
Why?
Well, Bradley, a 13 seed, beat number 4 Kansas, and then they beat number 5 Pittsburgh, and this is pretty unusual, although not as unusual on the men's side as it would have been on the women's side for that to happen. George Mason beat UNC, number 3 seed in that area, in that bracket, and, you know, UNC beat Duke earlier this season. A lot of people thought UNC might go deep into the tournament. Instead, George Mason is there, and Wichita beat number 2 Tennessee. All of these were surprises, and they may all be wondering as they wake up this weekend what they're doing there.
Well, but hopefully they're not wandering too long. And wasn't there, you know, some talk beforehand, some controversy about these teams even being invited? You know, there were a lot of critics of this.
A lot of critics, and there always is lots of chatter about who should have been in the tournament and wasn't, and who was seeded too high and who wasn't regarded highly enough. And that's why they play the games, in order to find out how it really should come out.
You know, I hate to put you on the spot because you've got all these grids right in front of you, but I'm hoping that my Final Four are still in. I got Duke, BC, of course, we know that, UConn, this is the men's. Is Gonzaga still in?
I have to look at my charts.
Yes, they're all right. So, okay, I'm all right. But look ahead. What games are a must-see on both sides?
I love to watch Tennessee play on the women's side. And Tennessee next plays Rutgers, and Rutgers is one of those teams that has been almost always very strong, but not quite ever strong enough, you know, to get to the finals or to win the thing. So that'll be a good game. That's a number 3 Rutgers against a number 2 Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
And that should be fun. And the other one that should be fun on Friday is Wichita State against George Mason. These upset, triumphant upset teams get to play each other, and one of them is going to have to win and go on even further in the tournament.
Bill, you know they're both winners for getting this far.
So far, I mean, their alums certainly feel that. There's no pressure on these guys.
Right. A minute left. Is there some story of this tournament that, you know, we haven't paid enough attention to?
Robin, maybe the only sad thing about the NCAA tournaments is that they are so thoroughly and completely covered by so many people that I'm not sure they're... It's sort of like the 2 weeks before the Super Bowl in football, that you hear so many stories about the condition of the toenail of the defensive end on the team that, you know, it just goes on. There can't be any secrets left. And so what you do is you watch the games and you hope for new stories to develop even as you watch.
Well, if one does, Bill will have it for you. Only a game host, Bill Littlefield. He'll be covering the tournament and a whole lot more this weekend, as usual, on his excellent program, Only a Game, on public radio stations. Bill, as always, thanks for stopping by with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. We'll be right back. mature discussion of body parts. Eve Ensler made one part of her body, the vagina, a star, the centerpiece of her stage play, The Vagina Monologues. It featured women around the world talking about their vaginas and led to an international movement to make people aware of and prevent violence against women. It even has its own day, V-Day. But as Eve writes in the introduction to her new work, you'd think that after becoming comfortable with my vagina, I could relax, get on with life. But this was not the case. The deadly self-hatred simply moved into another part of my body. Here she reads her own words, some of which might not be suitable for all listeners.
What I can't believe is that someone like me, a radical feminist for nearly 30 years, that I could spend this much time thinking about my stomach. It has become my tormentor, my distractor, my most serious committed relationship. It has protruded through my clothes, my confidence, and my ability to work. I've tried to sedate it, educate it, embrace it, but most of all, erase it.
Eve Ensler reading from The Good Body, her newest play, in which she examines the extremes women go to achieve an impossible, though much advertised, standard of beauty. This week she's brought her show to Boston. We spoke to her when she started the play's 20-city tour, and I asked her if it was true that she actually kept a journal of her inner dialogue with her stomach.
Yes, I did. I had a journal where I was in dialogue with my belly for about, actually, 2 years. You know, I was so shocked to see myself obsessing about my stomach. I think part of what we really need to do is be in dialogue with that part of ourselves and bring consciousness to it, because it's most illuminating.
Well, tell me, what did you think about your stomach? I mean, I've met you. You're a beautiful woman. I have not seen your stomach. But what was it about it?
It was that it was not flat. It was flabby. It was out of my control. Mm-hmm. Do you know, I think once you hit 40 as a woman, your body changes, and then 50, it really changes. And no matter what you do, it has a life of its own. And it was really this desire to really investigate what that self-hatred was based on. Every woman I talked to, bar none, except for maybe a couple of really enlightened women in Africa and India, just about every single woman I talked to on this journey hated one particular part of her body.
You also found that you had issues with food, perhaps related to your parents. Your mother was beautiful. And
blonde and perfect.
Yeah, there you go. And you didn't feel you could live up to that.
Mm-mm.
I think
there was this aesthetic in my family. My parents were gorgeous. And on the outside, everything looked really perfect. And inside, it was a completely different story. So I think our bodies often manifest and take in all that we can't express, and they begin to be the places, sort of the repository for all that shame and confusion and doubt and self-hatred. And, you know, I grew up in a very violent family, both sexually and physically. And, you know, I think, you know, for a long time, I didn't really live in my body. I had separated, kind of disassociated from myself early on after all the abuse. And when I finally came back into my body, then it was like, oh, I see why I haven't been here. I get why I took off. What's really fascinating to me is it really doesn't have a lot to do, in many cases, with reality. You know, often the thing that women hate the most about themselves is the most beautiful and the most unique and the thing that makes them exactly who they are. And that's the thing they're desperate to get rid of or shrink or die or fix.
Well, let's talk about some of the women that you spoke with. Women who are trying to lose weight at fat camps. On another occasion, you went to a clinic in Los Angeles where they were doing what?
Well, it was a vaginal laser rejuvenation center, and where women were basically tightening their vaginas and trimming their labia majora and minora to make them more symmetrical, which, by the way, is a fastly growing business. And I spent 2 weeks in the center interviewing women. I spent time in surgery watching the surgery. I spent time with the women before the surgery. I was in a vulva support group, if you can believe there's such a thing. You know, one of the things I always say about this whole journey is I would have all these judgments, and then I would get there, and either I would be so moved by why women felt compelled, or I'd feel like in Rio I was like, lipo. Maybe a good idea, because any place that you're in, within the context of it, it makes complete sense. You know, the tragic ending of this play is I'll go to Rio and I'll finish with lipo, which will be the anti-feminist ending. But I didn't end up doing that.
In fact, you end up in Afghanistan. You recount a story of eating ice cream there. I mean, it seemed like the most extreme version of what you've been talking about throughout this. Women can actually be killed in Kabul if they're caught eating ice cream.
Yes, and it was true because it was perceived as lascivious. You know, there are moments in your life where you go, wow, wow. I am sitting in a place, you know, in a little town called Jalalabad, which was actually the stronghold of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, in a little bazaar with the Taliban circling in their pickup trucks, in a back room with sheets pulled around us, you know, as this woman was eating ice cream. And I was thinking to myself, it is the year 2000 and whatever, and there's a place on the planet where it's illegal to eat ice cream. You know, it was truly, and yet women are extraordinary because they had found a way to keep their sexuality and their pleasure and their desire alive. They had found a place where they could go to eat ice cream.
Well, and as you write, and you being there, finally, my being fat is clearly less important than being free. I eat the ice cream. It reminds me that, I mean, what I took away from that is that we, American women, we're our own Taliban. We do it to ourselves, whereas in this other country, they had to have a dictatorship to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's that myth of women in the West being liberated and compared to women in the rest of the world, which I always take great issue with. You know, the forms of oppression in the West are much more sophisticated. In Africa, when they end the tradition of female genital mutilation, it will be over. It will be done. Women there actually like their bodies. They didn't have that cellular injection from the time they're five, you know, to feel like they need to look a certain way. That seems to me much harder to overcome because it's psychological and it's imprinted in your DNA. It's a much harder thing to get through than ending a certain tradition which is cutting off a part of your body. And I think we need to be really aware in the West, not only how oppressed we all are and under this tyranny, but how profoundly and massively we are exporting that around the world.
Eve Ensler speaking about her new play, The Good Body. And I'm wondering, how do you feel about your tummy now?
You know, I have my days where I look at myself and I look 52, and that's interesting. But it's not awful anymore. And what I will say is something's changed in me. I think that I've come to really love my body. I think what I'm learning is that the more we can turn that self-hatred into a form of service and into usefulness, the more relieved we are of the burden of it.
Eve Ensler's play, The Good Body, is currently on tour. It'll be playing in Boston through this Sunday, in Scottsdale, Arizona, at the end of April. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
Where'd you get those eyebrows, honey? You don't have to look. Was it potential attributes of your future offspring? It must be fun to be perfect. Fun to be perfect.
How would we know? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Vince Fairchild, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shurgitz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Daniel Estrin and Molly Hamill. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. We're all perfect. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Perfect people do. Thank you, darling. Where'd you get that body, baby?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and